Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. My colleagues, Judge Bea and Judge Bumate, and I are delighted to be here. I come from a place where I think it's 104 degrees today, so I'm going to enjoy the weather here today. Just a few housekeeping matters before we start. Basically, I'm going to call the cases in the way they are on the calendar, and there's a couple submitted cases I'll call first, and then we'll do argument cases. The way that by your case, if you're here for argument, you have a designated time amount. If you are expect to be kept to your time, and if you are the appellant, that is all of your time. So if you wish to reserve any time for rebuttal, if you're the appellant, it's your responsibility to keep track of the time, but I'm looking right at a clock, and the clock counts down, and then it goes up, and just because it's going up doesn't mean I gave you extra time. That means you've moved into overtime. So if aspirationally you tell me how much time you would like to save, I'll try to remind you when we get to that point, but it is your responsibility to keep track of the time. I note that on the calendar we have one case, the third one that's on for argument, that parties have divided their time, and when we divide time, it says on the calendar how much time you've left. And I know that it looks like it's the appellees that are dividing their time between 17 and 3 minutes. And if you're the second person to talk and you see the person just talking up a storm, and don't go in a panic and think you have to tackle them to get your 3 minutes, I will make sure that you get your 3 minutes. If the court's asking additional questions of someone, even if your time's up, please continue, as long as I want to make sure that I and my colleagues have an opportunity to ask all the questions, but otherwise expect to be kept to your time. Obviously, inherent in this really important job of presiding judge, I do have the authority to give a couple of extra minutes if we take up all your time, but I'm not saying that I would do that. But on the other hand, I do have that if we have a lot of questions and we want to leave you a little bit of time. The first case on calendar, United States of America versus Rolando Hernandez Zamora, has been submitted on the briefs. Case number 24-7502 will be submitted as of this date. The second case on calendar, Joa Claiborne versus Frank Bisciano, submitted on the briefs, 26-87, and will be submitted as of this date. After we hear argument on the first two cases, we're going to take a short recess just for about 10 minutes. So if you're on the last case, don't go far, because we'll reconvene in 10 minutes, but we'll take a short break. The first case on for argument today is Monte Handy versus Jacob Jones, 25-5105. Each side has 15 minutes, and as a reminder, if you are the appellant, that's your total time. So good morning, and we're ready.
Good morning, and may it please the court. Joe Busa, on behalf of four officers of the Anchorage Police Department, I would like to reserve 3 minutes, and I will do my best to watch
the
clock.
Thank you.
Mr. Handy presented a serious threat the night he was shot. He reportedly beat a female victim inside of his home, and then he set up for an armed confrontation with the police. And when they arrived, the officers ordered him to come out of the apartment with his hands up and empty hands so that they could safely arrest him and safely attend to his victim. But he defied those lawful orders, and he knowingly chose armed escalation and confrontation. He emerged from his apartment twirling a pistol grip shotgun. And he made sure that all of the officers on scene knew of his armed defiance by holding that gun over his head as he walked towards the officers before bringing it back down. As he continued walking, he flicked the gun out in front of him and flicked it back down real quick. The officers, trying to avoid the necessity of using deadly force against Mr. Handy, repeatedly and urgently ordered him, hands up, drop it, drop the gun. He shouted back, "No, nope, fuck you."
So when you're discussing the facts, obviously, because the party that was ruled against, we have to assume everything that they say in their favor. And the district, and I'm assuming that you're stating the facts that basically are undisputed, the district court stated that it could not, quote, determined based solely on the complaint and the video footage of the incident that the amount of force used did not constitute a violation of the Fourth Amendment, unquote. Why doesn't this determination justify its denial of qualified immunity?
Because that determination did not take into account all of the undisputed facts and the totality of the circumstances, and it essentially repeats the error the Supreme Court reversed in Barnes versus Felix. By focusing on the moment of the threat, the district court, like my friend on the other side here, has focused almost exclusively on the direction the barrel of the gun was pointed at the moment the officers opened fire. But the Supreme Court has made clear that under the Fourth Amendment analysis, you have to take into account the totality of the circumstances. And there is no dispute about the relevant totality of the circumstances here. And it includes
I'm just commenting on some things the district court said as support for the decision. The district court noted that Mr. Handy, as instructed, had exited the apartment and was, quote, walking at a casual pace, unquote. Did he nonetheless pose an immediate threat to the officers? I think what is the relevance, if any, of the fact that not all of the officers fired?
Those facts are all irrelevant to step one of qualified immunity and for sure at step two of qualified immunity. To take the question of armed resistance to arrest, my friend on the other side has not even disputed for you on appeal that Mr. Handy was engaging in active armed resistance to arrest. He was ordered to come out of that apartment with his hands up and empty hands for everyone's safety. He chose armed defiance and resistance to arrest by coming out with a gun and then defying repeated lawful orders to drop the gun. That is not compliance. That is complete defiance and resistance to arrest. The district court didn't cite a single authority for the notion that one can engage in lawful armed resistance to arrest as long as you're complying with one of the orders, i.e. the order here to come out of the apartment. And I would urge the court to look at cases like Gertzinski from the 11th Circuit, cited in our brief, and I apologize for the pronunciation. The 11th Circuit has said very clearly, at least where orders to drop the weapon have gone unheeded, an officer is not required to wait until an armed and dangerous felon has drawn a bead on the officer or others before using deadly force. And the 4th Circuit in the Elliott case, also cited in our brief, has made the very important observation that no citizen can fairly expect to draw a gun on police without risking tragic consequences.
Was there any case out there that obviously the gun, apparently wasn't pointed at the officers at the time? You're talking about other facts that are around there. Is there any case out there that says that the officers have to wait until the gun is actually pointed at them before they can draw? And obviously, I think one of the things, the fact that there were a number of officers out there, that some didn't feel they needed to fire right then. Others felt that they did, and my understanding of the law is we analyze this from a reasonable officer's perspective, right? So they don't – does it have to be unanimous that everyone – is that a reasonable officer standard or
– No, Your Honor. So the fourth –
You see what I'm – asking you.
I do, Your Honor. The Fourth Amendment requires only reasonableness, and this court, like all of the other courts of appeals, has made clear that reasonableness is a spectrum, it is a zone, it is not a single point on the spectrum. And I know of no case offering the unreasonable conclusion, sorry, no precedent, offering the unreasonable conclusion that if multiple officers are on site, they all have to open fire at the exact same time, or every single one of them has committed a constitutional violation. No case from this court or any court of appeals says so. And to the contrary, the First Circuit in the Rahim case, cited in our brief, makes the point that actually when multiple officers on site all decide to open fire, that reasonable use of force is required. That actually is relevant to the totality of the circumstance and indicates to you that, look, multiple people on site determined all for themselves and independently that the use of force was necessary to deal with Mr. Handy's armed aggression that night. On the question...
We have four that fired?
That's the allegation, four that fired, yes.
Okay.
So, and then On the question you asked, is there any case saying you have to wait until the gun is pointed at you to fire? No, and there's a mountain of case law to the contrary. We discussed this in our opening brief at pages 39 to 40, footnote 3, a giant footnote, and I apologize. We wanted to catalog the cases for you to make the point. All of these cases stand for the common sense proposition that an officer is not required to wait until an armed and dangerous and defiant and actively resisting arrest person draws a bead on them. And also, this court has specifically rejected that unreasonable proposition in the Napook case. And the district court erred, clearly as a matter of law, in declining to apply that squarely applicable precedent of this court. There's no grounds on which it is possible for a district court not to apply that binding.
What is the case that the district court cited that not pointing the gun is not necessary?
I'm sorry, if Your Honor is asking what case the district court cited for that proposition, I don't believe the district court cited a case for that proposition. What the district court did instead was focus on three of this court's cases, George, Lopez, and Nahad, and it read those cases at far too high a level of generality, repeating the error the Supreme Court identified in Casella versus Hughes, where it reversed a decision of this court and said that, with my apologies, this court's application of step two of qualified immunity did not pass the straight face test. With respect, that's exactly what happened here in the district court again. George, Lopez, and Nahad have no relationship to this case whatsoever. George, just to rehearse it for your honors, George involved a terminally ill brain cancer patient who obtained a pistol from his truck. His wife, fearing for him, called the police. When the police arrived, she was safe and in their protective custody immediately at the front door, unharmed. The officers go around back, and they encounter Mr. George on a second-floor balcony. He's not advancing on them. He never defies orders to drop the gun, and he never moves the gun, much less pointed at any officers, or defies any other lawful orders. And the officers shoot him. And this court holds, well, in those circumstances, merely holding the gun is not enough to justify the use of force. Lopez is even farther afield. It's a young boy playing with a toy gun in a time and place where young boys would be known to be doing such a thing. The officer was not even responding to a call for service. The young boy had engaged in no criminal conduct, didn't even know it was an officer. When he hears drop it, turns around and gets shot. That bears no relationship whatsoever to the facts of this case. Now, the district court and my friend on the other side want to draw from these two cases the very broad principle that simply holding a gun, period, means the officers cannot shoot you. What you have to do, I think, what they're saying is the person who is engaging in armed defiance of arrest would have to move the gun. I'm sorry.
Can I ask you about what's incorporated into the complaint? So there's a dispute about the 911 calls and the commentary and the video. First off, if we were to agree with your friend that none of that was incorporated, what survives of the 911 call? What would come in to the what can we consider the officers knew at the time?
So the complaint makes clear that the officers were responding for a call for service related to domestic violence. And as you know from this court's case law, such calls are among the most dangerous an officer can respond to. Danger is known to be lurking around every corner, as this court has said. So that would be in the background of a reasonable trained officer's mind.
We can infer that someone was hurt and in danger at the time, even though, because that's what the 911 call reported, right? That she's probably hurt.
That's correct. The complaint says that they were responding to a domestic violence call, and so I think our officers take that very seriously, like I think all officers should. Two, the complaint itself says that the 911 caller saw Mr. Handy prowling outside the apartment armed. Now, the complaint says elliptically it's armed with a bat or a gun. The point about the incorporation by reference doctrine is to prevent exactly that kind of selective incorporation in quotation of an underlying document. It's frankly bordering on misleading by omission, because as everyone knows from the summary video, which is entirely incorporated by reference.
Is it expressly incorporated by reference? I just was looking for a line on that, but.
So page one of the complaint, I believe, says in all caps, quote, all video footage, end quote, shows that the plaintiff should win here. And there's six, I believe, screen caps from that video. Now, there's two reasons.
Sometimes they incorporate the actual, like, YouTube webpage, but that hasn't.
That did not happen here, Your Honor. Now, there's two reasons that the dispatch audio comes in and is incorporated. One is the video is incorporated, right? And I think everyone here agrees that the body cam, the dash cam, the doorbell footage, all and the audio associated with that all comes in. Now, the key principle from COJA is that if a little bit is incorporated, the entire document is incorporated because the entire point is to avoid this kind of sort of artful pleading. And number two,
sorry to interrupt, but what, because I want to give you time for your rebuttal, but what's the argument that the commentary would ever be incorporated?
So the commentary, because it's part of the document, would be incorporated, but it's completely irrelevant to the Fourth Amendment merits. As we have always maintained in district court and here, the commentary, all the post hoc information no one on the scene would have known at the time, it's completely irrelevant to the Fourth Amendment question.
Let me ask you this, though. It seems for the analysis of the reasonable officer, it has to be what the officer knew to analyze the force used. So what did the officers know? If they didn't hear the entire 911 tape, what my understanding somewhere, and correct me if I'm wrong, that the officers, something about a couple of shots and the, what did the officers know when they fired their weapons?
Your Honor, I just want to note, I'm down to 2 minutes, and so I want to address your question. But
well, you have to answer my
question. I absolutely
agree. So I'm glad you want to.
Happy to. I just want to make sure I'm reserving some time for rebuttal. The only block quote in our...
That's aspirational, but I'll give you a couple of minutes for rebuttal, okay?
Your Honor, the only block quote in our opening brief is of the all of the information that the 911 dispatcher is relating to the officers on scene. And if you watch the summary video, you will hear the 911 operator tell the caller, okay, I'm relaying all of this to the officers. And then you hear the 911 operator saying, you know, to all the officers responding to the incident at Barefoot Drive, and then she sends essentially all of the main facts that the 911 caller had related to her. Those facts include that the caller had heard loud thuds against the wall, the woman begging, please stop. What she thought sounded like, maybe it sounded like two shots inside the apartment, that Mr. Handy then exited the apartment armed. And at first the caller says it could be a bat or a gun. But later the caller expressly says she has reviewed her Ring camera footage and now she is certain it is a gun. That's left out of the complaint. All of that, and then Mr. Handy goes back inside the apartment. All of that was relayed to the officers in that dispatch audio. But I want to be clear, we win on the dispatch audio because it's part of everything else that's incorporated, also because it's extensively referenced in the complaint itself. There's 18 total sentences referencing the dispatch audio, including descriptions of the content of that dispatch audio, just misleading by partial omission descriptions of that audio. So the audio comes in for two reasons, but just to be clear, we win even without the dispatch audio, because of everything else that is undisputed to be incorporated. Mr. Handy's armed resistance to resist and defiance.
But let me find out if my colleagues have any other questions.
No, thank you.
All right, I'll give you 2 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you. All right, we'll hear from the other side.
Morning. May it please the court. My name is James Roberts. I represent the plaintiff appellees in this case. The district court properly denied qualified immunity at the 12B6 stage in this case because after reviewing the complaint and incorporated video, the court determined that a reasonable jury could find Mr. Handy did not, he was not a threat justifying the use of excessive or use of deadly force because he did not make any furtive gestures, any harrowing gestures or furtive movements, any serious verbal threats. The jury could reasonably find that he did not manipulate the weapon in any threatening manner. He was not ordered to stop and thus did not violate or disobey any commands to stop. And he was not warned of the use of deadly force if he were to continue walking towards the officers, which he was doing in...
He was told to put his hands up to what... But he didn't... It's undisputed in the record that he didn't follow certain commands of the officers, is it not?
That's true, Your Honor, but this circuit has found in cases where someone didn't comply with an order, such as in George, where he didn't comply with the order to put his hands up or to drop the weapon, or in Lopez to drop the weapon, or in Nihad to drop the weapon, that that was not justification alone in order to use deadly force.
Well, you suggest in your briefing that clearly established law holds that if a person holding a gun does not point the weapon at an officer, the use of deadly force will be unreasonable absent justifiable provocation. Why didn't Mr. Handy's actions constitute provocation here?
Yes, Your Honor, and I think that—
I mean, obviously, we don't ever want anyone to be shot if we can avoid it. But I don't think the case law says that officers have to wait until they see the gun go off before they can shoot. They don't have to let that person with a gun have a tactical advantage. And so I'm asking, where is it clearly established that you have to wait, pull it up and point it before an officer can shoot and loses all tactical advantage and is obviously going to be on the losing end of that?
Well, first off, I agree with you. There is no case that says an officer has to be staring on the barrel of a gun before he uses his own, right? But what this circuit has said is that that adequate provocation, and this is from the George case, it's reflected in other cases as well, furtive movement, harrowing gesture, or serious verbal threat. Having a gun is not enough. You need that provocation.
Didn't we have all of that here? He said F you, so that's a threat. He twirled the gun above his head. That's a furtive movement of some sort, or at least it's an aggressive movement. What else are we missing?
Well, I would disagree that that was a threat. I don't believe that F you is a threat. I think it's profane. There's no doubt about it. But I'm not sure what the threat is. If you were to say that to me, I don't know what the threat is there. It's profane.
It would seem pretty threatening. But
it would say, I'm not going to comply with your order to show my hands without a weapon.
There are different things that could have been said. However, also the twirling of the gun above his head, that he didn't twirl a gun above his head. He raised the gun up into the air, and as we alleged in our complaint, he did so that the officers would see that he did have the firearm and would not be surprised when he came down there. What we have in cases like Hughes...
Would a reasonable officer have to believe that when you show a gun? I mean, that's more threatening than anything.
Well, I think I would respond to that in that no officer shot in that moment. If they felt threatened in that moment, no one shot and allowed him to continue moving.
But then he kept on going after saying F you, so...
And no officer told him to stop moving, right? And I think that's one of the key issues here is that in cases that were cited by appellants Hernandez or Napak, in those cases, the suspects were instructed to stop moving forward towards the officers. They were actually commanded to stop. In Hernandez, the officer put her hand up, signaling to stop, told him to stop moving, and he also had no reason to be going towards the officers. Whereas in this case, he had been instructed to exit the apartment and was doing that. He was complying with that order to exit, walking towards the officers, and had not been told to stop. In Napak, he was told to stop multiple times. He rushed at the officers multiple times, causing them to retreat. They again told him, if you come towards us, we will shoot. And he said, you're going to have to shoot, right? I think that is much more of a threat. That implies you're going to have to shoot to stop me. Right. And Hernandez, not only did he refuse to stop when told to, there is a harrowing gesture there. When he's told to stop, he raises his hands 45 degree angle with the knife and starts yelling at the officers as he approaches. That is a harrowing gesture. Right. Accompanying a disobedience to stop when going towards the officers. In this case,
in a couple of the cases that you cite, Morris and Lopez, and I think your friend on the other side was referencing those, how he interpreted them. The individuals who were shot were not suspected of having committed a violent offense. Why isn't Mr. Handy's case distinguishable here? Because we know that the officers have in their minds that shots were fired and it's domestic violence. Why isn't a violent offense suspected here?
Well, actually, in George v. Morris, this was a domestic violence call. She called stating that her husband had a gun, and then he wanted her to hang up the phone, so she did. So when the officers arrived at that scene, they knew they were there with a domestic violence call with a gun where the person was ordering the alleged victim to hang up the 911 call. So I don't think this was just simply a brain cancer patient with a walker. This was someone who was armed and dangerous and was suspected of domestic violence. And in that case, this court found that when the officers arrived and the suspect and alleged victim were separated, the threat from the alleged crime had dissipated. And that's what we have in this case. That's what the district court found in this case, that when Mr. Handy had exited the apartment in compliance with the order to do so, the threat from the alleged offense they were there for, a domestic violence crime, had dissipated.
So the officers should assume that the shots fired previously were for the domestic violence victim, and that someone that commits domestic violence with a gun would never turn that against an officer?
I don't know if the officers need to...
That the statistics don't really support that. I mean, more officers are hurt on domestic violence calls than probably any other ones.
Well, that is what this court has found and what was cited by the district court in this case. However, again, in George v. Morris, there's a domestic violence call, and the court didn't say, well, there's domestic violence, therefore the use of force is justified, or the use of deadly force is justified. It's a totality of the circumstances, right? And I know that Felix v. Barnes came out. It was a case that was originally in the Fifth Circuit. I'm actually from Texas. I handle Fifth Circuit cases all the time. I'm intimately familiar with what the Fifth Circuit was instructed in Felix v. Barnes. What that says is that you have to look at everything. It's not just look at what the call was for. Look at what he was doing in this moment. And I will say, I want to comment on the fact that much has been made that we discuss where the gun was in the moment that the shots were fired. And we're not trying to use that as a moment of threat, but we're trying to show that when he had done nothing to instigate them firing up until that point. And when they did fire, he hadn't raised the gun. And the Anchorage Police Department came out with a public statement. This is in our complaint.
Then, in their minds, the gun had been fired. There have been two gunshots previously. So he had used the weapon in the officer's mind prior to that.
Possibly. I know that there was one 911 call.
We have to go with what the officers knew at that time.
And I think that's exactly the key. We have to go with the officers knew, and at this point, no discovery has been accomplished. We don't know exactly what the officers knew. We don't know what the officers knew when they fired the weapons, what they were seeing, what they were hearing. We don't know what they heard from dispatch. It was told to us by the other side that 911 had dispatched certain reports from the 911 call. However, we have no idea what officers heard. And I have many cases in 1983 claims where officers did not hear what was reported over dispatch. They were looking something up at the time. They were talking to another officer. They were trying to figure something out. They didn't hear this information.
In this case, I mean, your complaint does say that there was a 911 call that dealt with, domestic violence with him, your clients and his girlfriend, and that there was potentially a gun used. So wouldn't a reasonable officer have reasonably inferred that someone could be hurt and dying in that apartment and needed to get into the apartment immediately?
I completely agree that that is a reasonable inference to make, and that's why they ordered him out of the apartment, and then he complied with that order to come out of the apartment. I think what we have to remember is what exactly the clearly established rule is in this circuit. And
on that, I want to ask, the district court discounted the Ninth Circuit opinion in Napook versus Las Vegas because it was decided after Mr. Handy was shot. Do you agree that that particular case is not applicable to this case?
I believe that that particular case, it's applicable. I don't think that you can discount it simply because it came after the incident in question here. However, I think that when you apply the clearly established rule that we were asking this court to apply, it falls directly in line with that. And that clearly established rule, which is followed by George, Lopez, Nihad, Hayes, Hernandez, and Napook, all state, or they don't necessarily state, but this is what they follow with the clearly established law, deadly force is not justified even against an armed individual at a serious crime call, such as domestic violence, if they make no furtive movements, harrowing gestures, or serious verbal threats, they do not manipulate the weapon in a threatening manner, they are given no commands to stop, and thus do not disobey a command to stop, and no threat of deadly force is made when feasible. Following that rule comes to...
Yes, but when the opinion... Now, whether you can say that it really didn't say anything that wasn't already said, but let's say hypothetically, you've acknowledged that there's no case out there that says the gun has to be directly pointed at the officer before the officer can fire. Let's say that case stood for the proposition, happened after, that a gun has to be pointed directly at an officer before an officer can fire. Then it would stand for that proposition. You can't say it was clearly established at the time that the officers were out there, right? So cases that happen after, if they deal directly with the facts of the case, they're not clearly established until after. So it does matter when the case comes out, right?
Well, I think it does matter when the case comes out for clearly establishing the law.
Yeah.
But for
you... that's prong one.
Right. But as far... well, clearly established being prong two of the qualified immunity analysis. But whether or not there was a constitutional violation, that prong one,
right,
the case could still be used right there. And, but what I'm saying is that following this clearly established law that was used back in George, Lopez, and Nihad prior to our case, this court still followed that same rule in Hernandez and in Napak. They didn't change the rule. They followed that rule.
I just gave you a hypothetical where the rule... it, you acknowledged there isn't anything out there that says you have to be pointing directly.
No,
and
absolutely
not. If a case came out after that said that it must be pointing directly or you can't shoot, that wouldn't be clearly established at the time of the event if it comes out after, right? I mean, the timeline matters.
For clearly established cases, yes.
For that prong. I'm sorry. I misspoke on one or two.
Yes, Your Honor. But what I'm trying to get at here is that Hernandez and Napak didn't create a new rule, right? They followed the same rule. The difference is in Hernandez, there was a harrowing gesture, the 45-degree angle of his arms, yelling at the officers. There was refusing to obey the order to stop. He continued coming after he was ordered to stop and then did a harrowing gesture. In Napak, he continued coming after told to stop. He was told deadly force would be used, and he said, "You're going to have to shoot me," and continued coming. Both those cases, they were approaching the officers with no reason to do so. Those cases don't fall in what the clearly established rule says, so qualified immunity should have been granted in those cases. But when you look at the facts of this case, and you look at the facts of George, Lopez, and Nihad, they do fall within this clearly established rule.
But counsel, he was told, drop the gun, and he didn't do that, and he kept walking toward the police. Is that not refusal to follow... orders of the police?
Well, it was refusal to drop the gun, yes, Your Honor. But George, he refused to drop the gun. Lopez, he refused to drop the gun. Nihad, he refused to drop the knife. Hayes v. County of San Diego, he refused to drop the knife. This court has made clear that simple refusing to drop a weapon is not justification. That's not provocation alone. There has to be more. The furtive movement, the harrowing gesture, the serious verbal threat. That's what you had in Hernandez. That's what you had in, Napak. You don't have those here. And again, they had called him out of the apartment in this case. He was walking towards the parking lot. He was never once told to stop. He was never once warned that if he continued walking towards the officers, they were going to use force against him. So they basically just waited for him to get to the parking lot and then shot him. With no warning this was about to occur. No warning that he needed to stop walking or force would be used. No warning that drop the weapon or force would be used. No warning of stay right there, do not come any closer. They called him out of the apartment. He's walking out. No other warnings or threats are given. He steps down and they shoot him. And again, the reason that we talk about where the gun was whenever he was stepping down into the parking lot is that one officer, one defendant officer, and the Anchorage Police Department both made statements, this is in our complaint, that when they shot, it was because he was raising the gun at them. However, the video is clear that he was not.
Is there a case out there that says when you're advancing on officers that they have to tell you stop or they have to tell you what they're going to do? And is there a case out there?
Yes, there are. So the Hayes v. County of San Diego, which is a Ninth Circuit case out of 2013, it's 736 F3rd 1223. In that case, they walked in to his house. He had a knife. He had it raised, and he started walking towards the officers. They shot him. This court found that because he was not charging but walking slowly, no order to stop and no warning was given, that qualified immunity should be denied. Exactly the facts that you just posited.
Well, but one's a gun and one's a knife. And the distance that you close with a knife is different than, you know, I mean, hypothetically, I can shoot you from here. You don't need to get closer. It just depends on how good a shot I am.
Right. But the warning to drop the weapon, the warning that deadly force will be used if you don't, the warning to stop walking forward, that's irrelevant of what you're holding in your hand. You can make that. They had time to issue that warning. They had time to issue that command. They didn't do so. Also, in Nihad, again, this is a knife, I agree, but he's walking forward, and the court found that because there was no warning that deadly force would be used, because he wasn't commanded to stop, that qualified immunity was denied. Again, George v. Morris, I think, is directly on point here. He wasn't walking toward the officers because he was on a balcony, but he had a gun in his hand. The officer said they told him to drop the weapon, and he didn't.
You're in overtime. Unless my colleagues have any additional questions, I'm going to ask that you sum up in the next 30 seconds.
Yes, Your Honor. I think we really what we're asking the court to do is follow the exact same clearly established rule that the Ninth Circuit has used in George, Lopez, Nihad, Hernandez, Hayes, and Napak. In the cases where the suspects do something threatening, which is a harrowing gesture, a furtive movement, a serious verbal threat, manipulating the gun or the weapon in a dangerous manner, refusing to stop when ordered, right? In these cases, such as Hernandez and Napak, qualified immunity should be granted. However, in cases where that's not what occurs, qualified immunity should be denied. Just like in George, Lopez, Nihad, and Hayes, that's the facts of this case. Thank you very much.
Thank you for your argument. All right, you have 2 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. Just a few quick points. On the warning point, my friend has emphasized that the officers did not order Mr. Handy to stop. That is true. They couldn't order him to stop. He had to come out of the apartment with empty hands and disarmed so he could safely be arrested so that the rescue team could get into that apartment and safely attend to his victim. He has no option to slow that entire process by continuing to engage in armed resistance to arrest. He has to both keep walking and disarm, and he defied those orders aggressively. On warnings in AGDEPA, this court said there is no magic words requirement, and the warnings are necessarily context dependent, and there is no basis on which to require these officers to add stop moving to the long list of other directives that he is actively defying. And then in Napak, this court said that the lack of effective warning, quote unquote, can't overcome the other three Graham factors. So we would win regardless of any of what I just said. As to comparator cases in the second step of qualified immunity, my friend on the other side is urging you to adopt a clearly established rule of law at far too high a level of generality. In the George case, it is not true that George ignored commands to disarm. This court actually, that was a disputed issue of fact, and the court resolved George on the understanding that George had actually never ignored any warning to disarm. Napak distinguishes George on that exact same ground. So does Yurick, another case from this court cited in our brief. And I just want to close my last 30 seconds by noting you have the discretion under Pearson versus Callahan to choose whether to resolve a case at step one or step two. I would respectfully urge you to resolve this case at both steps. Officers, the public, potential litigants, and district courts throughout this circuit deserve to have the benefit of your guidance on all of these issues that have been raised here to conserve judicial resources in future cases regarding the same arguments and to ensure that everyone stays safe in future encounters like this. Thank you, Your Honor.
All right. Thank you both for your very helpful argument in this matter. This matter will stand submitted. Thank you.